You know, that instinct to leap without looking, that was his nature too. And in my opinion, some Starfleet's lost.
Why are you talking to me, man?
Because I looked up your file while you were drooling on the floor. Your aptitude tests are off the charts, so what is it? You like being the only genius-level repeat offender in the Midwest?
Maybe I love it.
So your dad dies, you can settle for a less than ordinary life. Or do you feel like you were meant for something better? Something special.
Transfer complete.
Hello, and welcome to Subspace Transmissions, the podcast where two Trek fans step into the arena and tackle the best, worst, weirdest, wildest, and everything in between that Star Trek has to offer. I'm Cam Smith, and joining me in the iStore...
This is Tyler Orton, debating whether or not to go through with his colonar.
And we're here this week to talk about the Kelvinverse 10th anniversary.
Yeah, Cam, this is kind of amazing that it's actually been 10 years since the Kelvinverse came into our lives, and we've only gotten 3 movies out of it. It seems as if a franchise like this could have produced 5 movies in that same time period.
One would think. And, now that we're looking at this 10th anniversary of the 2009 film, are you grappling with your mortality the way that captains do in pretty much every single movie?
Based on everything we heard in Beyond, where we had a 32-year-old man just debating whether, he's gone as far as he could in life. Yeah, you might say that. As I approach age 35 in the coming months,
right.
I feel like I should be put on an iceberg and just like...
I'm ready for my vice admiral job. In fact, I'm overdue.
Well, I know you're a cadet a year ago, so...
No kidding.
Makes sense. But Cam, this is such a kind of a weird one here in that this Kelvinverse is a little bit all over the place in certain degrees. But I think the biggest takeaway is, this is kind of a fun sort of movie series.
This ain't your daddy's Star Trek.
It isn't, but it does Star Trek in an entirely different way. And look, a lot of hardcore fans, they'll make complaints about it, but, it's not the 2009 one seemingly kind of... Do people really critique it so much anymore, the Star Trek fans?
Well, let's face it, the lens flares are never going to stop getting mentioned by the diehards. But you'll hear the odd kind of jab taken at it for its sort of action over, rational storytelling kind of fallback mode. But yeah, I remember there was a headline, I think it was The Onion, where it was after that movie came out, and it had gotten, I think, something like 95% on Rotten Tomatoes. It had a huge debut weekend. And they put out a headline that said, fans feel Star Trek too fun.
But at this point, 10 years later, I don't hear too many hardcore fans, complaining about 2009, at least. I think this is one of the ones that Star Trek fans were allowed to like this one.
I think, Star Trek fans have a really touch-and-go relationship with the films in general, in that the films have never represented really the best of Star Trek. They'll look, of course, at, Wrath of Khan or even First Contact, but... Overall, the movies don't tend to get folded into the same kind of viewpoint as the shows do. And I think this has generally aged as one of the good ones.
Yeah. And let's take it from there. Going into this, I knew that they were working on a kind of reboot of Star Trek. I wasn't really looking forward to it. I still felt as if there's... I was kind of over Star Trek during this period. I had kind of given up Enterprise halfway through the run of the series, and I've since gone back, and I now love seasons 3 and 4 of Enterprise. But by then, Nemesis, I was just not feeling it. And so I wasn't really looking forward to a young version of all these characters. I just thought it would seem like karaoke Star Trek to a certain degree.
Right.
And honestly, the first...
To the Beastie Boys.
Well, obviously. Intergalactic or Sabotage for you, Cam?
Probably Intergalactic.
I'm Sabotage.
I'm not a big Beastie Boys guy, so it's kind of like, I guess that one.
You dress like one. So.
That's true.
Yeah. So going into this, it wasn't until I think the second trailer that I was like, gosh darn it, I need to go see this. This looks incredible.
That's so interesting to me because, I was in a place where I wasn't a Star Trek fan at all. I'd seen all the movies for the most part. I hadn't seen the motion picture. That's the lone one I didn't see till later. But I remember seeing the teaser for the 2009 with just the building of the Enterprise and the Nimoy voiceover. And that sold me. Like, I was like, I really want to see this movie.
Yeah.
And I was actually disappointed with the first full-length trailer and even the one that came after. I was like, oh, this just kind of looks like kind of Top Gun to me. And it just didn't appeal to me. I was like, I don't know. Even though I had never really watched much of the shows other than a handful of episodes of TNG, I had some sort of... It wasn't based on actual, I think, really a good grasp on the characters, but I had a general understanding of how I felt about the characters in the original movies,
mm-hmm.
and I wasn't getting that from the trailers, and that was kind of bumming me out.
And these are very much kind of character-based stories, and one of the fascinating things, I think what we want to do with our retrospect on these three films here is think about what they add to the legacy, and then also think about, say, certain character arcs that we're able to pinpoint here. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that stands out, and we'll take it, you know, movie by movie, but the Jim Kirk journey in every single movie is fascinating to me, sometimes for very good reasons, sometimes for not so awesome reasons.
Right.
But let's start with 2009, though. We've done reviews of each of the movies. We've gone into the kind of granular. So I think what we want to do here is kind of like discuss what this adds to the legacy and take like more of a holistic approach to everything here. But that all said, I think we do need to discuss the first 7 minutes that in which J.J. Abrams makes his voice heard in the Star Trek universe.
Yeah.
And we've said it before on the show, it's one of the best 7 minutes that Star Trek has ever put together here, in which you establish the action, you establish the stakes, the universe, the emotional story that's going on between George Kirk and his wife. And I think it's just an incredible filmmaking for, you know, the way that you kick off a universe such as this.
Well, when you look at those TNG movies, I don't think any of them, regardless of the overall quality, are what I would call really visually confident movies. Whereas, like, J.J. Abrams, right off the bat, really sets the entire tone of his universe of what it's going to visually feel like, how dynamic it is, how alive it is. Characters are running on the ship. It's like, in just those 7 minutes on that Kelvin attack, he completely reboots Star Trek into what he's going to do going forward. I think, like, J.J. Abrams, he's an interesting mix to me, because in that he's very confident with his films, and yet he's also prone to being very indecisive on set and not really knowing what he wants. And I think you see a little bit of that nervousness often work its way in, and we'll get into moments in that throughout 2009. I think he gets a little better as he goes. But this opening sequence is like a showcase sequence. I mean, I would not be surprised if after he shot this, this was like being passed around to get him jobs.
Yeah.
It's like, just watch a 7 minute sequence and, you know, look what he can do.
Did it get him the job for Super 8?
Well, that was his small little project. And I think that one, you know, displays a lot of the issues that J.J. Abrams brings to all of his work, which it makes him a really interesting talent. You know, what do you have to really say about the directorial flourishes of Stuart Baird?
The man can do a dune buggy, that's for sure.
Yeah, right? Like, there's nothing there, whereas J.J. Abrams, like all auteurs, has his pluses and his minuses, and I think there's the pluses far outweigh the minuses in this 2009 film.
So, with regards to the overall kind of journey that we're getting here, though, like, they start small. Like, they start with what is influencing this character that we're going to be following throughout the entire course of the film. You know, his kind of almost a traumatic, you know, birth into this universe.
Right.
It also made me realize that I guess it had to be like an induced pregnancy, because every time we've heard it, like, he was actually born in Iowa.
Right.
But now he's born aboard a space shuttle in outer space. So.
Yes.
Which is interesting. But hey, look, a traumatic experience brought into this world. It influences him, his whole relationship with not having a father. I think it's a fascinating sort of like trajectory that you get with this character. And we know him from this series as having that reputation as being a bookworm here.
Mm-hmm.
And him at a young age, he's an incredibly smart guy, but he's got like this kind of edge to him that I don't think was there with the original portrayal that William Shatner was giving. But when he's introduced in that bar scene, Chris Pine, he's got this kind of Shatner-esque sort of spirit to him.
Oh, yeah.
Where he's not imitating Shatner at all, but he's got this cool vibe where I can totally buy Shatner delivering all these sorts of lines. And I just like props to Chris Pine for making this role his own, but like still imbuing the spirit of it all.
That bar scene is fantastic, by the way. The way it just opens behind Uhura and just follows through that whole bar is so kinetic. And again, you're introducing three characters in that sequence with Kirk, Uhura,
and Cupcake.
And, well, Cupcake, but also Pike as well a little bit later. And it's like all three are just nailed right out of the gate. We understand them as characters. They're far set up better in this one sequence than like a lot of the primary cast we've known and loved throughout the, you know, original series movies.
And running parallel to this, we also have the introduction of Spock, you know, from childhood and also into young adulthood with, like, just the incredible conflict that's going through this guy's life. You understand that there is conflict running deep between your two main characters here, and I think it's just, like, kind of genius script writing as we have here. And we're also introduced to, say, Amanda and Sarek in very interesting ways. And you look, I think it's very early on in the movie, you're rooting for both your main characters here. And I think it's just, like, genius on the part of the filmmakers for being able to do everything in... Ken, we're talking about, what, the first 14 minutes of this movie? Like, that's an incredible thing.
Well, and, you know, because of the alternate timeline aspect of this movie, they've also repositioned these two characters as rebels who don't really belong to anything, who find each other and unite as, you know, kind of finding a family amongst the two of them and then the crew. Which is something that didn't exist in the original series. As we said, you know, Kirk was a straight-A student. He was, you know, kind of like a Top Gun type guy. And Spock really didn't come across as, like, the dark rebel on the original series. Or even the cage.
Yeah, yeah. You know, I'm sure back in the 60s, maybe he did. You know?
Oh, yeah.
But thinking about, like, maybe the characters' journeys and maybe what they add to the overall legacy and what we understand about these characters, I think it's interesting in, you know, you have Kirk being kind of the hotshot kind of guy.
Yeah.
We've already debated him getting promoted from cadet to captain in the course of 24 hours, which is interesting.
And some moments like the Kobayashi Maru is a little douchey. Like, they definitely play up the douche factor of younger Kirk in a way that we've never seen before.
But I wonder, though, if his arc from the beginning of the movie to the end of the movie, is it one of the most pronounced Kirk arcs we've seen out of, I guess, 10 movie appearances in which this character has been in, though? Like, I think it is one of the best Kirk stories that has ever been portrayed on the big screen. And he's had a lot to do. Like, I still think that, like, one of the best performances Shatner's ever given is when he was reacting to the death of David in Star Trek III.
Yeah.
There's even great stuff in, you know, obviously Khan stands out, but
Khan's probably his best overall arc, like, for Kirk in a film, right?
If you think about where he ends up at the very end of the movie and just grappling with the death and the sacrifice of Spock, 100%, you know, but this is just kind of in a great journey because you find, like, a very flawed man at the beginning who kind of gets his crap together by the end.
Yeah.
And I think it's great. And you wonder, Pike says something very interesting to him at the beginning, like, you're the kind of guy who jumps in head first, much like your father.
Mm-hmm.
Starfleet's lost a little bit of that. I think we need a little bit more. And the thing is, Kirk's able to save the day by the end. And I think he's kind of proving Pike to be, you know, a very insightful sort of dude.
Right. The one thing is, like, I guess with the Kirk arc in 2009, it doesn't feel as organic as some of the maybe Kirk arcs to come, in the sense of, like, the movie is so often bending over backwards to put him into the position. You know, the chess pieces have to be arranged in the right place on the board to set this movie up at the end to be the crew we all know and love going off on adventures. And, you know, this would have never happened, but I almost would have loved a world where we got, like, a three-film trilogy of the journey of Kirk.
Well, it was surprising to me. I think sitting in the movie theater, I did not think that by the end of the movie, back, you know, 10 years ago when I first saw it, that Kirk was actually going to be captain by the end, just because of the inclusion of Pike there.
Yeah.
I kind of figured maybe at best he would be a Lieutenant Kirk, you know?
Right.
So as you say, yes, they did have to kind of do a lot of table setting just to, I guess, make him king by the end, which seemed a little bit silly. And it's something that they do try to address in the next film to varying degrees of success.
Yeah. I mean, this movie was very influenced by Batman Begins as well as Casino Royale.
Oh, yeah.
And I think the thing is, like, those two movies had a much easier track because it was one character. Because they had one character they had to kind of put into place. James Bond had to become James Bond. Batman had to become Batman. Or Bruce Wayne had to become Batman. But, I mean, with Star Trek, you've got all these other players. How does Spock get to where he's going? Where, you know, does Chekhov and Uhura come from? You've got to set up this huge family of characters on their mission. Like, that's just a much tougher thing to condense into a two-hour movie than what Batman Begins and what Casino Royale were doing. It reminds me almost more, I'm a big fan of the X-Men movie, First Class.
Yeah.
But you see kind of by the end of that, it's doing some of the logical leapfrogging that Star Trek, you know, in its kind of nitpicking moments does, where it's like, you know, in one scene, like, Xavier's like, oh, I'm hit by a bullet. Oh, I'm in a wheelchair. And it's just like, okay, I guess that's that now. You know, we got up to pace pretty quickly.
For you, let's talk about Spock, you know, both Prime Spock and Kelvin versus Spock. how do you think that they tackle this character? We kind of talked about him being kind of the rebellious bad boy to a certain degree.
Oh, yeah.
But even
I guess he is on Vulcan, though, right?
Yeah, but even like Zach Quinto's performance, I think we've been pretty lucky with the biggest notable recasts of Spock so far, if we're talking about anyone from Ethan Peck to Zach Quinto.
Even the kid's pretty good at the start of this.
Yeah, I was going to say Jacob Tremblay, but it's a different Jacob, though.
I don't think he was born yet.
No, I don't think so.
He was very close, yeah.
But I just think it's a very interesting take on who might be the most iconic character in all of Star Trek franchises.
Yeah, I've really struggled with Zach Quinto's Spock over the years, and that every time I would see one of the movies, I'd be like, something just doesn't feel right to me. And I was actually, as an exercise for this podcast, I actually marathoned all three in a row pretty much. Mm-hmm. I watched 1 and 2 back to back last night, and I got up this morning, ate breakfast, and watched Beyond. And it was really interesting to me to see when you actually watch them all together how good the character tracking is throughout movie to movie. It doesn't feel jumpy or wow, that character's really behaving differently than they did in the last movie. Mm-hmm. And I really did come around more to the Quinto Spock this time around, and that the journey did feel very complete. And yeah, I think the thing for me was more when I watched the 2009 movie, I'm very familiar with the Nimoy Spock in the original series, and they never really lined up for me. And in a way that, you can say, well, Kirk's different too, though, because it's alternate timelines. Circumstances would have changed maybe the way they turn out. But for some reason, I was always able to align the Shatner Kirk more so with Pine than I was with the Nimoy and the Quinto.
Do you think it's because of the emotional journey of the character in which you know Kirk to be a more volatile character than Spock? Mm-hmm. And so then if you have a movie where Spock is a more volatile character than we usually see him.
I think that's a big part of it, because I think walking out of 2009 and the times I watched it since, it was always like, boy, I'm watching Spock strangle Kirk on a console. this is not the Spock I'm familiar with, and therefore it feels weird.
Yeah. What about the inclusion of Leonard Nimoy in this? Would this movie, could this movie have gotten away with not having kind of a legacy character to pass the baton, or do you think...
Well, let's remember the second choice was going to be Riker.
Would that make it a little...
You know what? In an alternate universe, I want to see that movie just to see how they explain, the meaning of Riker to these characters.
I know.
how bizarre. When we get to Beyond, are they looking at a photo of Riker?
So who would have been a better legacy character than Riker? I think we can agree that Spock is the best legacy character to pass the baton. But who would have been maybe the next best in this situation? I've got one in mind.
Okay.
And only because... Again, it's an iconic character. I don't know if it quite makes sense because it's bringing up the question that you had pointed out, who is so-and-so? I just think for audiences, though, maybe Jean-Luc Picard, because he does have that Spock connection, and he could tell him, look, in 100 years, you're going to be a very important, person with regards to the relationship between Vulcan and, I guess, the former Romulus.
Yeah.
So I think Picard could have passed that on.
I wonder if maybe they... had some minor conversations with him, and he was just like, no. Because he has said that he would, for a long time, he didn't want to play Picard anymore.
I can buy that.
And he was doing X-Men at that point, so he's like, what are you kidding? I got X-Men now.
Yeah.
So, that's possible. I think Picard does make sense in terms of the logic of it, and that, yes, he has a relationship with Spock.
Yeah.
Some and also
cowboy
with Kirk,
diplomacy.
And also with Kirk, right? From Generations.
That's right, yeah.
And so you could have him acting as that sort of mentor kind of role
he
for
could
those
have
two.
Cooked eggs with Chris Pine in this one.
Exactly. Yeah. So, no, that makes
chopped
sense.
Wood.
Is there anyone from the original series that would have made sense just to connect, that cast to the, the original?
I think with the passing of Mark Leonard, I don't think, I think he would have been the most logical choice.
It would have been so strange to work in a Chekhov or Uhura. It's just
it wouldn't have felt right.
No.
Yeah.
It would have been more, that would have felt, I think, a little more fan servicey than what Nimoy does, where you're actually getting a really good performance out of Leonard Nimoy. When he's talking about how Kirk has to, basically set off younger Spock, and he's saying, my planet was destroyed, believe me, I am distressed, or what have you, and it's moments like that, you just totally buy the emotion Nimoy's giving off. And again, he's doing it through the veil of Vulcan, where they don't express emotion in the same way, and yet it all completely tracks. And it's funny, it's a performance, and not so much a performance, but it's a role in the movie that in many ways is kind of a gimmick. It's there, in many ways to kind of be hey, there's your beloved favorite coming in to meet the new cast. Mm-hmm. And yet it completely feels organic to the story they're telling. There's a little bit of goofy stuff with some of the stuff with Nero. But, you know, I mean, ultimately, the Spock relationship feels very organic and real and heartfelt.
So very briefly, let's just touch upon the other main characters. Not necessarily their arcs, because who knows really what your arcs are going to be. Look, let's start with Uhura.
Yeah.
Did you ever think going into this that Uhura would play such a big role in this? Especially because it wasn't like Zoe Saldana was like a giant star at the time.
Right.
But I
Crossroads.
I just wonder if they kind of recognized like how good she was. But the thing is,
in Crossroads?
Well, no. But like on set, I was going to say, but the thing is, they couldn't actually like give her additional scenes. Mm-hmm. This was being filmed during the writer's strike back in the day.
Right.
And J.J. Abrams complained a lot how he would have liked to change things on set with a script. I think they just had to go with what they had.
That's interesting, because I do wonder, when I see sequences like the, you know, when they beam back from the ship and they wind up in like the water tank.
Yeah.
And how much of this is just, you know what, we don't have much of a script, but we can put together a sequence and just kind of keep people running on the, mm-hmm. on a track so they're not, you know, getting distracted with clunky dialogue.
Yeah.
And a lot of that does feel like there's a little, I mentioned earlier, you know, the J.J. Abrams kind of nervousness, or sometimes he'll just throw in sequences because he's almost nervous to slow down. You get like moments like that that feel like that. But yeah, with Uhura, I think they knew they had to make this character much bigger than she was in the original series. I think it would be embarrassing, just legitimately embarrassing, to put out this movie in 2009 and background her like they did in the some of the, you know, original series movies.
And just thinking about, well, she was never well served at all in the original series movies.
No.
And I think that's just it, like, you know, Koenig was given like pretty much like third or fourth billing in those films.
Uhura usually gets one scene.
Yeah.
That's the way it often plays out.
But with this, I think they also recognize we actually need to have a woman in a prominent role here and give her good stuff to do.
Yeah, and when you've got like six guys on the crew and then Uhura.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think they hit it out of the ballpark with her. She was a very dynamic actress. I think what a score for mm-hmm. their, you know, producers to get Zoe Saldana in this. And then moving forward, when I heard Carl Urban, the guy from Lord of the Rings, is going to be playing Dr. McCoy.
You were like, obviously. He was at the top of my fan casting list.
There were rumors of Gary Sinise.
That's
who I wanted, you know. But this
is that like, too obvious, though? Is that like the lazy fan casting where it's like, well, he looks like him, ergo he is the right actor?
Maybe. But the thing is, I could totally picture Gary Sinise even just doing the voice.
He is a bit old, though, I think, at that point, right? Compared to Chris Pine?
Well, but compared to, say, DeForest Kelly,
I can buy it.
I thought Carl Urban was okay. I think if there's any character doing a bit of an imitation mm-hmm. of a previous character,
mm-hmm.
it's that performance. But it's not like one of those awkward imitations at all. It's something that I can really appreciate, and it almost feels as I'm kind of watching DeForest Kelly in another man's body or something like that.
Yeah, it feels in some ways, and this is a complimentary way, but like what Ewan McGregor was doing with the Star Wars prequels, where he was very much channeling Alec Guinness, but it was also very much a young Obi-Wan performance. Like, he was doing his own thing.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what this feels like. Yeah, you do get that Bones voice coming out of Carl Urban's mouth, but this feels like a more dynamic, younger Bones that we've never really seen before. And so I really like what he brings to it.
What did you feel about turning Chekhov into a boy genius who's all of a sudden kind of the Wesley character?
I'm a fan of this.
When I first heard about this, it's just like, oh, they really want to wedge every single character in. I just think Anton Yelchin's just giving such a great performance that I can't actually like be unfavorable towards this. I think it's pretty good.
Well, when you really define who is Chekhov, other than Russian, what else do you have to say?
I have to go back to the movies, though, because I think that's the more definitive Chekhov, at least in my mind, in that he actually seems uber competent.
Sure.
Which is surprising. But
uber competent isn't really an interesting character trait.
No, you're right.
They're all, I mean, it's Starfleet. Most of them are uber competent.
He was mostly kind of oftentimes just comic relief, too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And a lot of it was based on like kind of the accent or things like that. Whereas they finally found an angle, kind of like doing the Kirk Spock rebel thing. Within Chekhov, they found this interesting quirk with the character, and that, hey, because this Kelvin Burr starts a little earlier than the original crew would have been on this ship, we get to see him as like a boy genius. Mm-hmm. And I think it works really well. And it's a hook into that character that, especially for newbies, if you're a new person coming to this franchise who's never seen the others, and they portray Chekhov the way they did in the other shows, you'd be like, okay, like, whatever. But setting him up as like a boy genius is just an angle on the character that I think is really appealing to a newcomer. They can go, oh, okay, he's like the kid genius. I get it.
And you know, we can dive into it in a few moments, but I do like where they take him in Into Darkness as well, where they kind of, if you're a void genius, do you really just need to push buttons on a console, much like Wesley did for most of his run there?
Yeah.
The other notable one here is Sulu. I think they really got a lot of good Sulu moments throughout this. You know, just everything from that platform sequence where he's pulling out his sword, you know, like it's kind of the action pack sort of Sulu that's George Takei, he said it before, he's very happy with what John Chu is doing.
They also gave Chekhov and Sulu like equal amounts of stuff to do.
Yeah.
Whereas in the original series, once Chekhov came in, Sulu got the back seat a lot of the time, whereas I love that this movie really does balance its cast.
Did one, you know, Scotty come in a little bit too late in the movie?
At the hour 20 mark?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was kind of weird to me.
In really weird wardrobe, too. He has that big floppy hat.
Yeah.
I'm like, what? You know, everyone makes fun of the Chekhov outfit from Star Trek 3. I feel like Scotty's 2009 outfit is going to belong in that category. Like 10 years from now, people are going to look at photos of him in that floppy hat and be like, what the hell were they thinking?
Why haven't we seen cosplay at the conventions yet?
Because I haven't done it yet.
Okay. look, I think you can debate maybe the accent that he's doing, which we've heard a lot of complaints about Simon Pegg's accent in this movie.
I've heard compliments, though.
Well, Simon Pegg has even admitted it wasn't a great accent. He was trying to do different things with it. And then we've had Scottish people tell us that there's no one in Scotland that actually speaks like that.
Right.
Because it's just such this weird garble of different regional accents.
To be fair to Pegg, too, like Jimmy Doohan was like amazing at accents.
Yeah.
Had like a natural ear for them. Whereas I don't think Simon Pegg does. He's not known for doing accents, you know, in other film roles.
Yeah. But it's... Out of all the characters, he's actually the one that I have the most trouble kind of picturing
lining
as
up
Scotty.
With the original,
Scotty was such a different character to me than what we got here. You know,
like, I agree.
Even kind of he, like the Simon Pegg version, has these bursts of like utter genius where it just seemed like Scotty from the original was just kind of this hardworking kind of everyman who was just super, super competent.
Not only that, but you had moments where you'd have Scotty in command.
Yeah.
And there was no transition in your mind between, well, is he as good as Kirk? It felt like Scotty can do this. Like, Scotty is very dependable.
Would you put the Simon Pegg Scotty in the command
no,
seat at any point?
No, I wouldn't. Like, they play up... J.J. Abrams was not a Star Trek guy, but I think he found an angle, at least, that interested him for all the characters and how to make them authentic and feel real as characters. Whereas, like, I feel maybe Scotty's the only one he kind of was like, yeah, he's like the stereotype I've heard. Oh, yeah, he's the funny one. He's the one who says, you know, I'm giving her all she's got, Captain. Like, that sort of stuff. Like, J.J. Abrams, it almost feels like relied more on kind of the non-fan perspective on the character than what the fans know.
Yeah. So overall, I think we can agree that 2009, perfect way to relaunch a franchise that had kind of fallen by the wayside after an extended period.
I want to know, when that movie ends, and you get that soaring Alexander Courage music, and when you're in the theater watching this in 2009, how big were your hopes for the next film?
I figured, you know what, we're going to be going on a five-year mission exploring all these abundance of strange new worlds. There is going to be big time going forward for us in the future. And I was like, yeah, they're going to have a movie out, obviously, in like 2 years, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, when I look at the legacy of that 2009 film, I mean, yes, it rebooted Star Trek for a film era. That was not as long as I would have liked. But still, like, when I look even at Star Trek Discovery, it's bearing a lot of the stamps of 2009. Like, J.J. Abrams reimagined Star Trek for what is going to be this whole other generation going forward. Like, they are going to be touching back on not necessarily lens flares and, you know, the things, like, the really simple things people will point to, but more just, like, the energy, the sense of scale, the sense of, like, dynamic, you know, camera work. We're seeing that on Discovery as well. It's just... how do you make Star Trek feel for this particular time period? And I think J.J. Abrams nailed it. And to me, this movie really does stand as kind of the testament to what Star Trek could be for this generation.
And we can debate the merits of Into Darkness, but I think just as we head into it, there is, I think, a gap that really sucks out the momentum in this franchise, in which I think the gap is just way too long between 09 and Into Darkness. And the big issue is that Paramount wanted to retain J.J. Abrams, and they wanted to let him go do Super 8. I can understand that inclination on J.J. Abrams' part as well.
I mean, that's something like, say, Christopher Nolan does. He does, like, you know, Batman Begins, then he goes and does The Prestige. Then he comes back, and then he goes back and does Inception. You know, he liked to have his one for me, one for them kind of thing.
Yeah.
I think J.J. Abrams had the same idea.
I think the... But the thing is, how excited do you think J.J. Abrams was to go back and do a sequel to 09? I just didn't get the feeling that this is where his heart really was. I think he's doing... His damnedest to make a good movie. I just don't know this is what he exactly wanted to be doing next for him after Super 8.
When you watch the 2009, this feels like the biggest setup for what he wants to do with Star Wars. Like, the two movies are very similar.
Yeah.
J.J. Abrams likes building the universe and walking away.
Mm-hmm.
And it does not feel like he was particularly passionate about jumping into Into Darkness.
And look, I think the best thing that Paramount could have done, though, is said, okay, great, let's get Orci and Kurtzman back to do a script, then let's hire, like, a good, solid director.
And bring on Damon Lindelof as well, of course.
Yeah, and look, I just think that it would have been a different feel to the movie. It would have kept that momentum going, and I think we would have been in a very different place right now with the Star Trek franchise than we are at this point. And we can get into a little bit about what might be next for the Kelvinverse at the end of this show.
Yeah.
But I just think it's an unfortunate, you know, series of events that people didn't necessarily foresee, though.
Yeah.
And, well, let's get into it. Into Darkness. First time I watched it, you and I, we watched it together with another couple former guests from the podcast, one Benjamin Yong. And
I like that you're calling Benjamin Yong a guest at this point.
Yeah, well, yeah, he should be so lucky. fallen co-host Benjamin Yong, and then former guest Adrian McNair. He did our Star Trek Into First Contact is what it's about to call it. But Star Trek First Contact review. And we walked out of it, and we're all kind of like, huh.
Yeah.
And I remember before that movie came out, as we were looking at all the marketing, like, I was much more familiar with, say, J.J. Abrams, like, doing the TV stuff than you were, and also Damon Lindelof. I don't think, like, Lindelof is somebody I respect incredibly with regards to his TV output.
His films have been pretty, pretty muddy with Prometheus. And then I know he worked on World War Z, but I think about 37 people worked on World War Z.
Yeah. But that you weren't a big fan of World War Z.
I am not at all.
But it's actually quite well reviewed. And I think
it's modestly well reviewed. Yeah.
But the other thing is, like, you're taking it as a zombie movie. You watch that movie, it's not a zombie movie, it's a disaster movie. And as a disaster movie,
it's not very good.
No, it's actually a pretty good disaster movie as well.
I would argue against that, but fair enough.
You're in the minority, though.
Okay.
Yeah. Lindelof aside, like, I was actually happy that he was going to be joining the movie franchise moving forward.
I think I was at the time, too. I was like, oh, that's cool.
Yeah, but it was just such a weird one kind of going in. And they were kind of happy with the fact that they were going to be able to rewrite the script on set, unlike what they could do in the 09 one.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know, we got a bit of a weird one here. And I take it back to, say, the Kirk journey. But before we get there, I think we want to welcome a guest who approached me New Year's Eve and said to me, hey, Tyler, if you ever do something on Star Trek Into Darkness, you got to have me on the show. I want to talk about that, which is not something you typically hear from, say, hardcore Star Trek fans, even at, like, conventions or anything like that.
Right.
Joining us on the show, it's Michael Herman. You are a friend of the family. I've known you since you were a newborn baby. It is amazing to have you on the show. Michael, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me. Yes, I have been stoked to talk about Star Trek Into Darkness. And I'm not going to lie, I think you're going to lose a lot of listeners right when I say this. But Star Trek Into Darkness is literally I wouldn't say my only exposure to Star Trek, because how could you not know anything about Star Trek, right?
It's penetrated pop culture pretty deeply.
Exactly. Right? Yeah. But Star Trek Into Darkness is the only, like, film or anything that I've actually watched in full.
Okay.
So, yeah, like, pretty not knowledgeable about it. But, however, I know the reputation that Star Trek Into Darkness has.
Okay. Well, that's interesting to me because it's actually, like, quite well reviewed by critics. It's the highest grossing Star Trek film in history.
Internationally,
that baffles me.
Not domestically, but internationally,
No, but which includes, if you add domestic numbers and global numbers, it's the highest grossing Star Trek movie in all history, as I said. And so it's an incredibly popular film, though. So from your perspective, like, you're not off base with regards to, I guess, like, kind of the populist view. Just Star Trek fans aren't a huge fan of this one. So tell me, A, what got you going into Star Trek Into Darkness in the first place, having not been super familiar with the franchise? And then let's hear your thoughts over it all.
Well, I'm not too, like I said, I don't know a lot about Star Trek, but I know enough to know that this is not an action franchise. And I think there's a great line in that movie that is almost like, it almost could be meta. It's when, it's some Peg's character, Scotty, right? He says to Captain Kirk at the point in the movie, he says, "We are not the military, we are explorers." And in a way, that's actually kind of what got me into the movie in the first place, is that someone, you know, it was the next big action movie that came out. And I think, like, I almost want to talk about the Dark Knight influence, because I think it influenced a lot of movies of that era.
Definitely.
But from the little I know about Star Trek is that this is not an action movie franchise, but from what I understand is they wanted to bring in a bigger audience. And that's kind of, and in a way it worked, because that's why I saw the movie. I was like, Benedict Cumberbatch was kind of the hot new actor at the time, right? Everybody was getting into Sherlock and everything, and I remember even that being kind of the draw of the movie. And
he was all over the marketing. It was just long monologues from him over those trailers.
Oh yeah, and then so that was sort of just what, and I hadn't even seen the first one, but people, you were like, "Hey, let's see the new Star Trek," and yeah, essentially that's why what brought me to the theater.
Like, the marketing, actually, did it work for you? Did it seem intriguing based on what you were seeing there?
Yeah, in a way, it's almost blasphemous to say, and correct me where I'm off base here, because again, I don't know a lot about Star Trek here, but I know that, again, it's not, from my understanding and from what I've seen of, like, you know, clips on the internet, it's not really about, again, they're not the military, this is not an action franchise, this is about, you know, it's supposed to be our woke new future. And then especially when you get to the, I almost want to talk about the Alice Eve scene, because that one stands out to me as the most bonkers choice that I even saw in that movie. Again, we talk about the first interracial kiss on TV happened on Star Trek, and then we have something like the Alice Eve scene. You guys know what I'm talking about, right?
Yeah. No, I don't. please describe it for me, Mike.
Well, okay, so Alice Eve plays the, this is a special type of character. It's called the Dr. Sexy Science Lady character. And there's a numerous of these characters that have popped up in other movies.
James Bond movies.
I was going to say Denise Richards.
Christmas Jones.
Yeah. The crop top, you know. Throw in a lab coat and call it a day if you want. Olivia Munn in The New Predator is the most recent one. And I'm not saying attractive women can't be scientists. But, like, yeah, the scene where she just takes off her clothes.
What reason?
To put in the trailer.
Yeah.
To put in the trailer. Again, maybe that was another reason why people... Because even Alice Eve was also another hot young actress. I don't think that really ever panned out. But, like,
I think there was a bit of a bad lesson learned, because they had the underwear scene in the 2009 film. Like, they're like, well, people thought, like, this new Star Trek was, like, sexy and fun, so we got to do that again. But wait, this movie does not have scenes that lend themselves to that type of material. And they were like, well, we got to just force a moment in.
It is incredibly awkward.
Yeah, it's really stupid. Yeah.
Especially because she says, "Don't turn around," and Kirk just turns around. Like, I watched it again.
She's like, "Whoa, whoa,
whoa." She's like, "Don't look." And he's like, I'm like, dude, it doesn't take a genius to know she's changing, probably.
But the thing is, it also goes completely against the Kirk as we know it, though. Yeah. Like, I know that Kirk has a reputation in pop culture as being this real horn dog. If you watch the series, he actually isn't. And he's actually, like...
That's Riker.
Yeah, but for, like, the 60s, he's actually... very professional when it comes to, like, fellow female crew members.
Yeah, because look at how tortured and, like, stretched out the whole Janice Rand stuff was. Like, I mean, she's only in, like I said, 8 episodes, but I mean, they're constantly kind of tempted, but he's not going to give in because he's the captain.
But, like, it just doesn't really jive with him that he's doing something like that. And look, what we were discussing before you joined us, Mike, was, you know, Chris Pine's overall take on the character as well as his arc here. And I don't think the Into Darkness take on Kirk is a particularly flattering version of Kirk. I think he looks kind of buffoonish for much of this movie, unfortunately. But that, I think, I'm influenced very much by my own familiarity with the character. I think he actually works quite well for general audiences. And the other reason I brought up the marketing question for you is, like, did the movie appeal to you? As Cam said earlier, this movie actually did underperform at the domestic box office. The marketing, I think...
It's so interesting, because I just remember how much people loved the first one. And, like, I know on, like, DVD and Blu-ray, it became really popular. And the studios really did think, we've got the next Pirates, or we've got the next Batman. Like, the second one is going to explode when it grossed less than the first one. I have to imagine there's some head-scratching, but also, you look at what people loved about the 2009 movie. It's the fun. It's the energy. It's these characters, you know, enjoying one another's company and bouncing off one another. And Into Darkness is like, we're going the opposite route.
Yeah.
It's so weird.
As Mike was saying, they were going like the Dark Knight Rises route.
Yeah, I mean, this whole movie.
Or sorry, The Dark Knight.
The Dark Knight, yeah.
Sorry, I just want to briefly touch on that because, yeah, when I mean like the Dark Knight effect, I remember the gritty reboot was sort of, and obviously, well, Star Trek 1 came out in 2009.
Yeah.
You know, so after The Dark Knight, that became like a common trend within Hollywood. It was the gritty Dark Knight reboot treatment. They tried it with The Amazing Spider-Man. Even the new, they kind of backtracked a little bit, but the Power Rangers movie that came out.
Yeah, the Fantastic Four second version.
Exactly. Yeah. No. It was kind of the thing to do, and they tried it with Man of Steel. They basically tried the Batman approach with Man of Steel. And I think they're starting to realize that certain properties, it just doesn't work.
Star Trek doesn't necessarily lend itself to that, I say that, although there are certain series like Star Trek Discovery or Star Trek Deep Space Nine, but I don't know if the film format necessarily lends itself to that, especially with Star Trek, because I think it works best when it's being more of that optimistic, kind of vibrant sort of deal.
I think there's a problem, at least for me personally, with Into Darkness. And yeah, rewatching it last night, I found it more, I guess, enjoyable than I usually do, in the sense of watching them back to back between that and 2009 going in. It is interesting in that it does kind of continue to track the Kirk journey. Like, this is very much like the humbling of Kirk throughout and teaching him to kind of be a good leader as opposed to just a hotshot who got the bridge.
Mm-hmm.
But to me, it's like, that is a story you want to tell. But then also having this whole conspiracy tied to Starfleet, to the average viewer, and I want to hear from you about this, Mike, but I mean, we've just learned from the first movie, like, Starfleet is this thing we should aspire to. They don't even really delve into Starfleet that much. We get to the second movie, and we're like, Starfleet's bad. They're corrupt. And it's like, okay, didn't we just meet this organization? Like, I thought they were pretty cool.
Mm-hmm.
And this feels to me almost like more of what should have been movie 3, movie 4.
Right.
As opposed to movie 2, where it's like, the previous one ends with like them launching, like, we're going to space. And then we crash back down to Earth and everything's terrible.
But Mike, you brought it up. The appeal for you, though, is like, you hear, oh, we're not military. We're explorers, though. Like, how did you kind of take away kind of this Starfleet storyline, in which they reveal that there is kind of this conspiracy of kind of their black ops sort of division that is trying to prime the galaxy for war?
Right. So I almost want to address what you were saying, too, is that you were saying that from your perspective, and I haven't seen the movie, but from my understanding, the first movie is like an origin story for Captain Kirk and Spock, for the characters that we were supposed to get to know. Captain Kirk becomes the captain of the Enterprise by the end of the first one, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that there's overall a problem in the first act of almost, I wouldn't want to say table setting. So what you're talking about with me is that saying that Starfleet being bad by the second movie, there's a bunch of kind of weird, baffling, kind of weird retconning things they do in the first 15 minutes. Like an example, Captain Kirk being stripped of his rank, then being second officer, and then 5 minutes later getting promoted back to the exact same spot he was before.
Actions have consequences, Mike, obviously.
He was really depressed for like 5 minutes.
Yeah. Clearly you saying to me that them rushing something, that is no surprise to me.
Right.
And so, sorry, what was your main question wanted to get to?
Like, did it work for you that Starfleet was being portrayed as kind of had a lot of rotten apples that had to be addressed, knowing that the appeal for you is that they're explorers, not a military organization? Did it actually jive for you? Because I think that was actually one of the big issues that a lot of the hardcore fans had with this film, and just how dirty Starfleet was being portrayed when it's supposed to be more of an aspirational sort of organization.
Yeah, exactly. Because, my knowledge of Star Trek, like I said, I would describe as the woke future. And obviously, it's a product of its time. So there were some missteps along the way when it comes to the TV.
Oh, there's some missteps.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. But, you know, in a lot of ways, it's very much, you know, ahead of its time. And I don't get that from this Star Trek reboot. If anything, it's sort of what I feel about the new Star Wars. And yeah, sorry, I hate to put Star Wars and Star Trek in the same sentence, guys.
I think it's okay now.
But you know what I mean? But there's Star Wars, I feel like, mimics the Marvel formula to a degree. And it's funny that these franchises that pioneered so much try to be something that they're not.
Yeah.
And so, again, you know, while I'm not a big Star Trek to feel like I was betrayed by the fact that it took itself more of an action movie franchise. I think that's ultimately its downfall, because it turned into a generic action movie from where I was standing. All the nuance was gone. So the explore aspect, at least we would get, I don't know, but yeah, like I said, more nuance. And even the beginning is kind of a cool setup. You got this, ancient civilization that has not been exposed to technology. Mm-hmm. And even exploring the repercussions of them seeing the Enterprise and what that has on the world. Like, I want to see more of that. That setup, right, to me is kind of interesting.
And they do that a lot in the TV series, like those kinds of implications. Unfortunately, it just doesn't really work for devoting an entire 2-hour movie to discussing the implications if you want to actually get audiences into the theaters.
Yeah.
It lends itself better for kind of entire episodes of a series to do that. But the thing is, you're getting at something that kind of irked me about this one. Like, Cam, you brought up the fact, like, didn't the possibilities seem endless when we closed out the last one? This movie takes place on a total of 3 planets. We get to the opening one. Is it Nyru or something like that?
Something like that, yeah.
And then we hop on over to Earth, and then we bounce over to Kronos, and we're back on Earth again.
Yeah.
It really seems as if the universe is very, very small in what would be... And you look at the budget at this, and you look at the production values. I am blown away. This is the best-looking Star Trek movie that's ever been made.
It looks fantastic, yeah.
Yeah, but it just seems like you're kind of, constricting... in a way that I don't think that's where the franchise was headed.
I often wonder with this one. I remember there was a lot of interviews with Kurtzman and Orci coming off of the 2009 movie. You know, people really liked it and would say, like, great job. You know, this was a really fun setup movie, but Star Trek tends to be about philosophical issues and, you know, parallels to real-world events. Are you going to be doing that in the sequel? And they got asked about that over and over and over again.
Yeah.
And I have to wonder if they got a little bit insecure and they're like, we're going to do, you know, what's popular with like the Dark Knight, these kind of 9/11 parallels. And I think Batman's a character who's really makes sense to comment on that type of story and that type of real world event. Star Trek is, I think it could work, but what they go for is so heavy and often downbeat and morose that it's not what I think anyone really wanted coming off of the high of 2009.
I think you're right. I think this could have worked. It just, execution-wise, it just didn't do it, though.
Imagine if this is like the 3rd or 4th movie.
Yeah.
You have this like, okay, we've spent time with these characters. We've seen the optimism of what's out there and what they're experiencing. And then to be kind of brought back at home and realize that, hey, you know, it's like DS9. We'd been through the original series, TNG. It's not until DS9 where you're getting this real examination of the darker side of, you know, war and Starfleet and all that sort of stuff.
So... for me, let's think about the characters a little bit. You brought up the point that this is kind of Kirk's humbling. And I think that's a great direction to take the character after we saw he's diving headfirst throughout all of 2009. And he actually comes out okay in the end. I think it is a good story to say, like, look, hotshot, you do need to come back down to Earth. I think the problem is like, it keeps happening and he keeps getting kind of punched in the face for it.
Yeah.
And it just kind of makes you think like, oh, this is more of a buffoonish character that we're following. How can we be invested in this guy's journey when he seems to be making all these bad decisions? And I think it really, you know, it's at its zenith when he's in the engineering room and he's jumping on like that climax where he's jumping on that console and he kind of looks like King Kong or like one of the monkeys.
King Kong.
one of the monkeys from 2001 at the very beginning where he's just like hopping around on that. It just seemed like just the most bizarre sort of climax to this guy's journey.
Well, when you compare that to the Nimoy death scene in, in Wrath of Khan, where it's just like a couple barrels and it's very, just like very simple business. And then it's like Kirk swinging around on a giant playset and you're like, what is going on? But I think there's a lot of awkward moments for Kirk with, like you said, he looks like a dope. Like the whole scene where he's like punching Khan over and over again.
Yeah.
It's just like goofy. but then you get like these moments where he's learning, you know, right off the top, they're bringing up the needs of the many outweigh the needs of the few. And it is kind of Kirk learning that throughout the Kobayashi Maru that he kind of just ignored in the first movie, accepting that we may lose. He has a scene on the bridge where he turns to his crew and is like, I'm sorry, because he realizes they're going to die. And it's about Kirk taking responsibility for all the lives under him. It's just that, like, the way it does it in these key moments, like the swing from the playset, it just feels really, like, hacky and just kind of like, here's a big set piece to just kind of showcase it. Whereas, like, you want it more of those moments where Kirk acknowledges the people around him.
What did you think, though, of Spock in this particular one, Mike?
Well, I have one question, actually, just before that. So is Spock and Kirk, are these accurate to their portrayals? Like, is Kirk the loose cannon type that in the TV series that he's portrayed here?
No.
Not so much, no.
No.
Yeah.
Right, okay.
But the thing is, like, I don't have a problem with Chris Pine. I can... Look, we've seen how many hours of Kirk? He has different portrayals and different journeys in, you know, like, 100 hours of media.
Sure.
I'm okay with him going in this direction. I just wish it was executed better.
Right, and so what do I think... Are you talking about what do I think of Spock's, like, character arc throughout this movie?
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah, so from my understanding, so J.J. Abrams, I guess, likes to remake movies.
He's been known to do that. Once or five times.
Yeah.
Someone once referred to him as a nostalgia remixer. And I'm like, yeah, that's pretty accurate, actually.
He's all about the member berries.
Yeah. Right. And so, from my understanding, it's the Wrath of Khan, and they've just switched Khan and Kirk's characters, like, Spock and...
Well, with the death sequence, yeah. Essentially, in the Wrath of Khan, it's Spock who dies. Whereas in this one, Kirk dies for some reason and is brought back to life. And did anybody actually think that Kirk was going to die? So it makes you question, just from a filmmaking perspective, why we ever even went through that sequence, because it just rang so false to
us. I guess it's the accepting death, ultimately, with the Kobayashi Maru. But it's just like, it feels so clumsy.
But think about, are there real consequences for his journey? I don't know.
No, yeah, not really.
So that makes it kind of tough to stomach. And the other thing is, like, so one of the most iconic moments in all of Star Trek, Mike, is with one Captain James T. Kirk screaming, bellowing, Khan!
Yes, okay, I know, but yeah. I'm...
But the thing that really is lost in pop culture is that Kirk is actually putting on a bit of a performance in that moment. He wants Khan to think he's incredibly upset. He's actually tricking Khan at that point.
Yeah.
This is played completely earnestly on the part of Zach Quinto and Spock, and to me, you watch it as a fan, and you're like, oh, guys, this is cheap.
I shuddered in the theater when this moment happened.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I think just a general question about what do I think of Spock in this movie is I think he's one of the stronger characters in the movie.
He can lift a lot. Yeah, you're right.
Yeah. That too. he is maybe the most interesting arc out of all the characters, at least in my opinion. Although I was not offended.
Does it seem as if he had a lot to learn, you know, just about being a dependable crew member? You know, it seemed as if he had an incredibly tough time wrapping his head around why Kirk would be upset with him.
Yeah, well, okay, so I guess that Vulcans don't like to show emotion. That's the crux of whatever his deal is. Mm-hmm. And so he has to learn to, I don't know, he has that moment at the end when Kirk dies that he's like, no, I'm feeling emotion right now, or whatever it is. So it's clear that his whole internal battle is that he doesn't show emotion because he's emotionless. He just chooses not to show emotion. He sees it as weakness. And, I mean, that part is, sure, that's compelling enough. I don't like his relationship with Gamora. I don't buy it. I have not seen the first one. So, yeah, sure, I don't believe the setup. But I'm like, how could weird woke future aside, come on, man. Like, I just don't buy it.
It's interesting because none of this existed in the TV series or the original movies. But, Cam, I kind of buy it in this Kelvin verse. And that surprised me no other.
No, that's the relationship between Spock and Uhura works for me totally throughout these movies. Although this one, I've heard this complaint raised a lot in that, like, they really do present Uhura being unprofessional in a lot of situations.
Well, that's what I mean.
Regarding their relationship in this fight.
Yeah.
Like, give Spock a moment where he kind of does something, you know, kind of awkward too. Like, why is it always Uhura, you know, yelling and then Kirk looking awkward? And, you know, it's like, guys, like, let's at least change it up, you know?
The only thing, and I'm not trying to defend it, though, but you know that Spock is not going to be the one who, it's tough because you fall into these really bad stereotypes about the rational man and the emotional woman. And it's just like, oh, guys, do you really want to set yourselves up for this? Like,
and the thing about these scenes is, like, the actors are actually really good. And I think actually people get some genuine laughs out of it. Like, I think Chris Pine has a lot of fun with his awkwardness in these scenes. But it is something when you examine on the face of it, you're like, this is an unfortunate choice in many ways for a character who in the first movie, Uhura, was represented so well.
Yeah.
Well, you talk about being unprofessional. That's what I mean, is the part when they're going on a dangerous mission. He's like, should I bring you both? You guys are not going to, like, you know, like, start a catfight with each other. And he's like, yeah, no, it's cool. Like, we're cool. And then she's just like, you know, they're on the, they're in the ship, and then she's all like, I don't know. She starts complaining about something, and then it starts like a big fight, and then, you know, Kirk is awkwardly in the middle between that. And yeah, like, I know what you're saying. It's just, it represents unprofessionality for sure.
Yeah.
So for You, Mike, though, you watch this. Does this work for you just as like a fun summer blockbuster?
It doesn't, because the writing is so baffling at times. And like, I have a list of notes that are just that I could go into, obviously, but I'm not going to go into all of them. But it's just it's the writing that really lets this movie down. Like, we know J.J. Abrams can make a movie. We know all these people can act. The writing is really where it just like it lets it down. Not to, obviously, the plot holes and everything aside, but even one of the things I want to talk about, this is the part where Khan decides to get caught when he.
It's like he saw the movie The Avengers.
Yeah, exactly. That's another classic thing that sort of was a trend, was the villain purposely getting caught. That sort of started a new sort of trend in that.
Yeah, in Skyfall as well.
In Skyfall and Avengers, Dark Knight. I'm sure there's like countless others. But in this scene, he goes out of his way to get caught. Like, he is literally gunning people down and then goes up to him like, hey, I surrender. How would Kirk not be like a little bit suspicious of that?
Well, but the thing is, it is because of the torpedoes that are carrying his former crew. So I do buy his motivations for surrendering.
We talked about the 2009 movie, how they kind of rewrote Spock to be a rebel, to kind of pair him off with Kirk as this rebel. They're rewriting Khan in this one to be kind of a captain who's very conflicted, to line up with Kirk.
Yeah.
And it's a parallel I think is kind of interesting, but I just question whether Khan was the right character.
I think the problem was is they got too caught up with the potential to do a loose remake, and they didn't think about whether it really made sense. I think they're like, hey, you know what? Think about comic books. You have this huge rogues gallery of villains that you can choose from. Why can't we reboot certain villains? The thing is, I could buy them rebooting, say, the Borg Queen down the road. I could totally buy into that. But I think there's just something about Khan where you better have a really, really good idea in mind. And I just don't think that this idea really justified where they went here.
And it never really subverts our expectations.
No.
Because we think of Khan as, you know, this great villain from the movie. The Wrath of Khan, but he also had a reason to be really angry in that movie at Kirk and to want revenge.
It was personal.
It was very personal. I mean, I guess they go for a personal angle with all the people in the torpedoes. I still find that head scratching. Why you put all your friends in a torpedo? Because, you know, what if one just gets fired just as a test?
Well, no, it was Marcus that put them in torpedoes.
I thought it was Khan that put them in the torpedoes to hide them from Marcus.
No, I think how did they end up on the ship though? Right?
I thought Marcus wanted
them
shoot the Klingon planet.
Starfleet wouldn't tell them what was within the torpedoes. It's because they knew that the bodies were in there. And they're going to, like, you know, say, hey, Khan, we're going to shoot you and kill all your folks. I never interpreted it as Starfleet not knowing where the bodies were. Like, it was... anyways, we're getting to the minutiae.
That's what I mean. The plot is very head-scratching. And what I wanted to say about... It's not that I didn't understand why... Khan got caught. My understanding is how Kirk, like we're talking about him being kind of a buffoon in this movie. How is he not a little bit suspicious that this dude is like going out of his way to turn himself in, to the point where he's gunning down people so he can be like, hey, dude, I surrender. Getting punched in the face, still not even reacting to it.
Like, well, but Khan didn't know where his crew was. He didn't realize that his crew was aboard the Enterprise being ready to be fired out as torpedoes.
So why did he get caught then?
Because he found he was like, wait, you guys have torpedoes aimed at me. How many torpedoes do you have? Oh, it's the same number of people that were in my crew. My crew's been turned into these weapons. If I want to save my crew, I need to surrender.
Okay.
See, the fact that we all have very different interpretations of it, it just I don't know if it was spelled out all that well. But, and maybe I could be totally off base here.
But the thing is, like, a lot of the questions are like, why does Kirk go along with all this? And I think a lot of it is this movie's all about reactions to 9/11. And Kirk is thinking, like, you know, it's a very U.S. kind of idea of post 9/11. And Kirk is there who's like, yes, let's go into Iraq. Because, you know, we want revenge for what happened on 9/11.
Yeah.
And it's about Kirk realizing, like, oh my God, we can't do this. Like, this is a mistake. And coming around and giving his big speech at the end that it's about, you know, basically looking out for one another and journeying towards something optimistic as opposed to just picking on your enemies.
Yeah. So overall, if we think about the legacy that this, this one in the Kelvinverse, it hasn't held up well with like hardcore fans. J.J. Abrams did like an apology tour essentially when was it the Star Wars Force Awakens, when he was pretty much on the Into Darkness apology tour. I think there's some interesting moments in this one. There's some interesting ideas. I just don't think the execution
works. It moves well. Like, it's well-paced. And, you know, it doesn't have as many of those moments like the 2009 did, where it just kind of the awkward set piece for being a set piece for no other reason that has no impact on the plot. Like, yeah. actually, most of the action throughout Into Darkness is tied into what's going on in the story. Yeah. So I actually give J.J. Abrams some points for actually having more confidence in his storytelling, as opposed to just being like, I got to keep distracting everyone. But it does feel like at the end of the day, this one is just not the story that really works. And it's just trying for things that are just not the most pleasant to see in a Star Trek movie.
I think they hit lightning in a bottle with the 09 one. This is a bit of a misstep. And I think, Mike, stick around because we're going to start talking about Star Trek Beyond. And we want you to stick around and talk to us about maybe your thoughts on like what the future of the Kelvinverse holds. But I think they realized they needed to kind of go in a different direction for Star Trek Beyond. But yet again, it's kind of plagued by delays, whether it's director issues, script issues, or there's like multiple scripts written for this.
Yeah. Roberto Orsi was attached to direct, and that dragged it out.
He was not attached to direct it, though. He was trying to make a play to direct it, and I think the executives at Paramount just had enough. They tossed him in the script, and they started from scratch, and there's a lot of delays that ensued. They wanted it all to line up with the 50th anniversary of Star Trek in 2016, and then they did not market it as such because they thought it'd be lame to market something as 50 years old. And
yeah.
So that one had a lot of marketing issues going into it too.
Meanwhile, Bond on its 50th anniversary is like, look at us, we're 50. And the movie's like $1 billion grosser.
Yeah, that's a head scratcher, like what Paramount was thinking with regards to the way that they marketed Beyond. And the thing that you and I discussed a lot is like, we don't know how else you could have marketed this movie, but it wasn't well marketed, but it was still a fun movie to watch.
They were like doubling down on Rihanna music videos and stuff, and you're like, who is this going to grab?
It is baffling, but all that said, look, let's start with Kirk's journey. This is a young guy who's still kind of, he's on his 5-year mission, and he's like, okay, so this is kind of a common question. You reach the top. Now what?
At the age of 32.
But there's a great episode of Mad Men that really dealt with this. So it's like, okay, you've reached the top. So now what? And Kirk has to grapple with that because he's also thinking about like he's now at the same age as his father was when George Kirk died in 09.
Yeah.
And I think there's some very interesting questions about mortality. And this is about, you know, how Kirk gets his groove back, essentially. And I did have some initial issues with it because I'm like, it doesn't feel like the same Kirk that I would know who would not want to continue with a ship. And you especially think about how at the very end of Generations, I mean, you can criticize that movie all you want. The great piece of advice that Kirk gives to Picard, though, is never let them take your ship away from you.
Yeah.
Maybe that's just something that Kirk had to learn throughout the course of this film, though.
Well, we saw in the original films, he did become an admiral at a certain point after the 5-year mission.
So he didn't know that lesson just yet.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I keep thinking this is a weird one in that it seems as if it has every single one of the right ingredients to just be a great swashbuckling fun movie that's going to have mass appeal and please a lot of the Star Trek fans. And for whatever reason, and I cannot put my finger on it still to this day, this one just doesn't quite hit it out of the ballpark for me personally, even though I really like this one. And I think when we did our rankings, we both put it as the number 5 best Star Trek film out there. So for us, we like it, but Cam, do you have any thoughts about why this doesn't quite get up to the 09 levels?
I think it's not as visually dynamic.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't grab you with that same sense of like just you are on a, you know, you are just racing through this thing, having the time of your life. It's funny. It definitely evokes more of the original series, Star Trek.
Oh, for sure.
Which for fans is like awesome, but I don't know that that plays to a general audience as much. Like maybe they're like, well, hey, I love the 2009 one. That one was really fun. This one's not that fun. Like, it's just taking its time more. And so maybe it is kind of an issue, fans versus non-fans, what they want from a Star Trek movie. But even, like, the action scenes in this are not particularly remarkable at all. I think the destruction of the ship is pretty good.
Yeah, the ship destruction is pretty good. What were you saying, Mike?
I'm just surprised that you would say the action scenes are not very good. Because two of the things that I just wanted to comment on from what you're saying about this movie being more in line with what Star Trek fans would hope for. Simon Pegg is the one who wrote this one, right?
And that's co-wrote,
was very much his goal. And so that I understand. But when you say the action is not strong, like they brought in, again, talking about trying to get the action people in, they brought Justin Lin from the Fast and the Furious franchise. And that is sort of his bread and butter. And yeah, so I did try to watch Star Trek and Beyond. I'm not going to lie, I didn't finish it and didn't really pay much attention.
Okay.
But again, going back to that, Justin Lin, action movie director. You'd think, though,
and they even have a motorcycle sequence in this one, which you would think would lend itself to Lin's specialties here. But I'm with you, Cam. I think the best sequence was the destruction of the Enterprise, which that was actually a moment that shocked me, that they would actually go there so early on in the run of this franchise, that they're willing to do that, which to me, it's like, oh, there are consequences for, you know, it raises the stakes. But did you kind of feel tension, though?
Not really. And I think part of the problem is this movie had a very rushed production. And I don't know, you know, the second unit that Justin Lin was working with for the Fast and Furious movies. They seem to have a team locked down pretty good that does know how to deliver. Because we saw even, like, James Wan does the seventh one. And the action in Fast 7 is really strong as well. Like, I don't know how much of that is really falling on the second unit. Like, I don't know what was going on with this movie. They didn't have as much time to probably storyboard things and shoot them that you would with a better production schedule. And I think it's interesting we're saying the best one is the one that, you know, was the destruction of the Enterprise. That would have been all pre-vised and set up well in advance.
Yeah.
That's the effects team working behind the scenes for however long they have.
Whereas, I mean, beyond that, I mean, I can think of the motorcycle sequence. I can think of the Yorktown sequence there. But
you can have the whole, you can kind of tie the motorcycle sequence into the whole, like, taking of the gravel pit base.
Yeah.
Where you've got Jayla, you know, shooting people with a sniper rifle and other characters running around. And it's not particularly well done.
I think it's perfectly...
It's totally fine.
Competence. Yeah. It's perfectly fine. It's not bad.
But this is coming from the same series that gave us the destruction of the Kelvin.
I know.
You know, off that first one, and has some really memorable action beats. Even Into Darkness. Has them, like, running when the ship's, like, gravity is failing, like, on the sides of the ship. It's really inventive stuff.
Which, we did get that within the destruction of the Enterprise sequence, which it still works for me. Like, and I honestly thought by the end, like, they would haul the saucer section up and, like, recommission it. But no, so it is interesting that they were going to go there and have the introduction of the Enterprise A.
Yeah.
Which, you know, decades apart from the introduction that we got in the film series, the original film series.
Right.
So the other thing that we have to talk about is, like, there was a bit of a cloud hanging over this one. It's not only coming out, you know, right after the death of Leonard Nimoy, but also the death of Anton Yelchin as well, which is just kind of maybe bringing us to the next question, where the franchise goes from here.
Yeah, because I think, like, you know, just with Beyond, like, one of the things it did really well is continue to have these characters paired off, and we got really great things out of the characters. And I think that stuff still all works. Like, I do not think audiences are going to turn their backs on wanting to see this crew together, but they've got to deliver something that feel... there was actually an interesting article. I think it was on Forbes. You can probably search it out. Just Star Trek 4 canceled Star Wars. Just Google that. You'll find it. But they talk about how with Star Wars coming back, it made these Star Trek movies irrelevant because they just don't deliver something that the general audience cares as much about because they're getting it from Star Wars on a much bigger scale. And, you know, just Star Wars traditionally has always been known for having big, big set pieces that are incredible.
Right.
And suddenly Star Trek loses a lot of its luster. And, you know, you see that in the box offices of Beyond. It's like, if you're not going to bring it, fans may be happy. Like, we may walk out of a Star Trek movie that's shot on $60 million and be like, that was absolutely fantastic. They nailed the characters. They had an interesting philosophical question. But does that draw in the audience that Paramount wants? I don't know.
And I just don't know if Star Trek could ever reach those, you know, Guardians sort of box office numbers. I just don't think fundamentally Star Trek is ever going to be that franchise.
Mm-hmm.
And which, look, that's fine. There's nothing bad about that. It's just...
But and sadly, we live in a world, though, where everything has to be a mega franchise.
Well, that's just it. It's like they only... At this point, they only make movies with budgets of $10 million or $200 million. There's very little middle ground at this point. So... overall, look, I think Beyond is a fun movie. I like it.
I enjoyed it.
The character stuff is great. You know, I think Spock was actually, like, really... I really like Spock in this one. Like, it seems kind of like the Spock we know, I think, more so than the previous two movies.
And the relationship with Bones is fantastic in this one. Yeah, and... But,
Even Spock just giving his ex a radioactive necklace that allows him to trace her, which is super creepy boyfriend stuff, which they made jokes of, you know, like that works for me.
And just to tie it back to Kirk, I mean, this movie, I'd always had a real issue with post Beyond. It really seemed like we're never going to get another Kelvin versus movie. And we'll get into that in a second. But I mean, I always lived with this frustration with this franchise in the sense of, like, I felt like it was just this open-ended, like, well, I guess that was that. It felt like it kind of petered out, potentially. And what are we left with? We're left with these three weird movies that don't really lead anywhere.
They seem a little disparate. Like, what is the overall story that
they're
telling
not a,
here?
They're not a self-contained trilogy where you're like, wow, that really told a story. But when I finished this one this time, I really did feel like, you know what? By the end of this movie, I feel like Chris Pine has aged his performance into the Kirk we know from the original series really well.
Mm-hmm.
And so I can almost look at this as a Becoming Kirk type trilogy where, yes, he's gotten there by the end. Yes, he was on the missions earlier than, you know, Shatner Kirk was. But at this point, at the end of Beyond, and they're getting onto the Enterprise A, he has become the Kirk we all know and love. And so I can kind of accept it then. I have peace now that I hadn't had previously to this rewatch of going, well, if that's the story I get in these three films, then that's what it was doing. It was laying kind of the groundwork for, you know, how did they become these characters we know and love?
Yeah. Mike, I got the sense that you wanted to pipe in a moment ago.
Oh, yeah. Well, what I wanted to say was you talk about sort of by the end you were left with nothing, that by the end the series sort of petered out.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to know what the sort of the production history of this franchise has been, because from what I can understand is they almost sort of took the wind out of their sails a little bit. They had a good high going after that 2009 movie.
Yeah.
But even Into Darkness, what? So 2009 and then 2013 was the next one. And I know saturation of the market, you don't want to bang out too many sequels.
Yeah.
But even Beyond still didn't come out to what, like another 4 or 5 years after?
It's actually 3 years. But yeah, 3 years after Into Darkness, which the thing is, like, 3 years isn't unreasonable in franchises. But when your second one is, I don't know, like polarizing in some ways, or I don't know how well it held up just in terms of that 3 year distance people had. I don't really know.
Yeah.
It's tough to say with a general audience, but I think you needed that third one a little quicker.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's what I mean. Is like I think just the overall spacing of the movies, like I think even 2 years would have benefited Star Trek Into Darkness quite a bit. I would like to think so.
I think they should have done, you know, 09, have a second one out by 2011, mm-hmm. a third one in, say, maybe 2013.
Sure.
And then a fourth in to line up in 2016. And then by now, they should have already had another one out to commemorate the 10-year anniversary. So
assuming they want to pay the Chris Pine salary that long.
How cheap are these guys, though?
Yeah.
You know, but so that would have been 5 movies in 10 years, and I think it's a completely reasonable timeline. But the other problem is Paramount's just really been plagued by a lot of executive turnover. There doesn't seem to be like a real good direction, or at least somebody properly shepherding this. So
they should have took money out of Monster Trucks.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, it's true. Paramount's had some really expensive gambles. And
like Monster Trucks.
Yeah, like Monster Trucks. And I just don't know. To me, I mean, it's weird they were so confident in Star Trek IV right before Beyond opened.
Yeah.
You know, they signed Chris Pine and Zach Quinto, and they're like, they're
Hemsworth
coming back.
As well. Chris
Hemsworth as well. And they're like, they're coming for Star Trek IV. And then it was just kind of like this ongoing question of people being like, is it happening? And then, you know, S.J. Clarkson's attached. Oh, awesome. And then quietly, S.J. Clarkson leaves. And you're like, okay. And it's been radio silence regarding that film.
I think this is just goes to show that maybe certain types of mediums are suited better for certain properties. And I think what you guys are saying is that, yeah, Star Trek is a lot about, again, they're explorers, they're not the military, and maybe that is best suited in the television format, because you can tell those long-form stories. It's like, for me, the new Batman movie coming out with Robert Pattinson, you guys probably know about that.
We've mm-hmm. heard, yeah.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I'm actually in the camp that I'm done with Batman movies. They're detective stories. Let's get an HBO Batman series.
Sure.
You know, like that's what I'm all about.
So. Well, they have a Batwoman or Batgirl coming out
on the CW. No,
okay.
No, I'm talking HBO. Give me some premium,
like some
cable.
Prestige. You're saying,
yes, please, not CW. No more CW. No more.
Okay. But let's talk about kind of the future, because Cam, as you said, we were being told that we're going to have George Kirk reunite with Jim Kirk for the Star Trek IV that was supposed to already be given the green light. They had a script ready to go, an idea that J.J. Abrams loved. They were getting a director on board. We eventually got S.J. Clarkson, who's directed a lot of TV series before. And that one just kind of, I don't know, like fizzled out in a really unglorious sort of fashion.
Right.
But concurrently with that, though, there's also that Quentin Tarantino story pitch that another writer was going to, you know, delve into the script. So they had these two projects going on concurrently. For all intents and purposes, it looks like the S.J. Clarkson one is done. Right now, Quentin Tarantino is saying, oh no, I still plan on doing this Star Trek one. Yeah. I don't know if this is actually going to happen, but yeah, boy, I just want one last Kelvinverse film to, if they can just wrap it up, address some of the lingering questions that we might have, and maybe they can tie it all together in a certain way. Like, where do you want to see things going from here on out, Cam?
I guess, like, the Tarantino one, I'm interested if he wants to make it. You know, I don't know. Like, Tarantino is notoriously flighty with projects. Yeah. He announces things all the time. There's actually lists on Wikipedia you can look up of, like, the 37 films Tarantino claimed he was making.
Well, didn't you joke around in our WhatsApp group about Star Trek Vega Brothers?
Yeah. There's been so many. His, you know, Casino Royale movie he was going to make, or his Godzilla film. But, I mean, the only thing is, if it's a Tarantino film, I want Tarantino to be bringing himself to that movie.
Yeah.
Do I want to see a fourth Kelvinverse film, which these three have felt very unified as a three films together? Do I want to see one where suddenly it goes all oddball Tarantino? Mm. And I don't know. Like, that's weird.
Well, not a reboot. I think it'd be a one-off.
I would imagine so.
I think so.
Well, like, my whole idea is, like, if Tarantino is ever going to tackle it, why not just do, like, a mirror universe Tarantino movie? Like, that would actually make sense thematically within Star Trek. You could kind of justify why things seem to be askew.
Yeah.
You know, I could buy that. I just don't know if that's the direction that they're going. Honestly, I think that the best thing we could have hoped for is that S.J. Clarkson movie, because I suspect that it would have dealt heavily with time travel, and it would have been maybe jumping into, like, previous adventures that we would have been familiar with. I think it could have tied things together in a way that would have been satisfying.
And if it was the final one they made, it could have bookended nicely with the whole Chris Hemsworth stuff, with, you know, the opening of 2009 and this one.
Yeah. So,
yeah. As the average person on the outside,
I think you're above average, but go on, Mike. Yeah.
I just think, from the outside, like, I am way more excited about the prospect of Tarantino doing a Star Trek than
S.J. Clarkson.
Yeah. Unfortunately, that's sort of where I stand on that. But no, just overall, like, I think I don't understand why you guys want that, you know, that closure for that franchise. But, you know, if I had to pick, if they were going to announce the two, I honestly wouldn't. Even getting Chris Hemsworth, who I like as Thor, is not enough to me as the average person to kind of suck me back in.
Yeah.
But you say Tarantino's doing it. It's one thing if Tarantino writes it. I don't think he would just write it, because I think he had that experience where, what was that movie he did that he didn't? I mean, there's been a couple of projects that he's written and he's directed, but usually they kind of turn out pretty poorly.
So, well, like, I think True Romance is
True Romance. That's the one. That was trying to Woody
or
Harrelson.
Natural Born Killers too, which he was never happy.
Natural
with.
Born Killers. That's what I'm actually thinking. Natural Born Killers, because he wanted his name taken off that, right?
Yeah.
But I think he's been very adamant. Like, if this movie gets made, he's going to be the one directing it. So. Yeah. Okay, I'm intrigued by it, but I just let's say this crew is done from here on out, if that's the unfortunate thing. I don't think they can really practically reboot, say, TNG moving forward, especially when you have a Star Trek Picard spinoff going on at the same time.
I don't know,
starring...
Tyler. We have multiple Jokers showing up at the multiplex.
is your concern about... Because I know that technically you talk about the Kelvin timeline, that all these timelines are sort of canon with each other, right? They're reboots, but they're not really reboots. Isn't that what you're telling me?
They're alternate timelines, I'm totally fine with. It's never bothered me at all.
Right, yeah. Let Tarantino do a multiverse scenario. I just think it's snappy dialogue. I think actually his style would work well he would have to be R-rated, obviously.
He said he wants this to be a hard R movie.
Yeah.
But are we assuming that he's going to bring some of his mainstay cast back? Like, do you think Michael Madsen's going to play, like, a Klingon or something?
He's the new Kirk.
You know,
okay, this is what I want to get into. I have a fan casting for Kirk.
Okay, let's hear it.
Let's resurrect John Travolta's career as Kirk, Captain Kirk.
Oh my God.
Yeah, okay, this is why I think William Shatner and John Travolta are, like, so similar in the types of actors they are. That I think, like, you know, I had another reason, but... maybe the facelifts, maybe? I don't know.
Hair? The toupees?
Exactly. The toupees, the fact that they're both bonkers and weird.
Well, they basically have become, in many ways, parodies of themselves. Yeah. Often, you know, self-knowing.
Yeah, and I think if you get Travolta to deliver his lines, what you would expect from a Tarantino, like, Tarantino films take themselves seriously, but they're very tongue-in-cheek. And having, like, I mean, you just get Travolta to play that straight and play it with absolute sincerity. And I think you get some, you know, unexpected laughs, But I think it would work in the favor, because that's sort of what Tarantino films
are
about.
Okay, so let's say the movie kicks off with a transporter accident.
Sure.
And that's why Chris Pine's no longer in it. And that explains, you know.
I won't worry about that. Just reboot it.
Okay.
It doesn't count. Travolta isn't playing the older version of Chris Pine in this.
So guys, overall, this is a strange franchise. One I think we overall like, but one incredible movie, one pretty good movie, and one that we have a lot of issues with, but we still find it actually quite watchable, only for like kind of the character moments and the action sequences. I want them to move forward with this. I think this is the best we can hope for when it comes to Star Trek and the movies. Star Trek has always been strongest in TV. This is finally kind of Star Trek making its, after, 40 years, like its real big screen debut for mass audiences. And I think it worked out as well as we could hope with all the big gaps between the movies.
These movies also arrived at a time when there was no Star Trek on TV.
Yeah.
And now that Star Trek is bombarding at least streaming networks, is there still like that demand to have Star Trek on the big screen and you're getting all these different series showing up on CBS All Access and elsewhere?
Yeah, and maybe I would be far more invested in the future of the film franchise if there was no more Star Trek content that we would be devouring week to week.
Mm-hmm.
So I
just don't know that there's necessarily that appetite, which I think 2009 benefited from and, definitely ran with the best. Yeah. Okay, so I think on that note, our assignment is complete. If you enjoyed listening to this podcast, we want to hear from you. Jump on over to our Facebook page at facebook.com/subspacepod. Tyler, what are we doing next week?
Yeah, we're going to be doing a Discovery review of Season 2. We've already seen every single episode. I think we've had some time, about a month, to sit on it. We can kind of think about it, but it's going to be a bit of a review with a twist. I don't want to spoil it just yet, but come in and be prepared for something interesting. We're going to have one of our guests who often comes in and does kind of these big episodes with us when we kind of think about things more holistically like this. So look forward to David Boris next week.
Awesome. Okay, so you can also find us on the Twitter. I'm at Cam V as in Vengeance, Admiral Marcus's ship, Smith.
You can find me at Reportin, that's R-E-P-O-R-T-O-N, N as in Nero needs a new haircuts guy, otherwise known as a barber.
And Mike, are you on Twitter?
I'm on Instagram at Apex Creative Co.
Okay, awesome.
Rolls off the tongue for all those listeners.
Does, yep.
Yeah. Okay, so until next time, the arena is closed.
Transfer complete.